Hey, so any severed cat heads in your yard today, sir?
Wow, you gotta be like that. We kept the cat in last night. Although I don't know why. I don't know why. I mean, all the mutilations started mid-August. And, you know, Terry's been going out ever since, and he's kind of been cool. Like, you've been to our house. Like, beside us there's 40 acres of green space, and that's just kind of where he hangs out. I don't think the psycho kitty killer's hanging out there, so I think we'll let him out tonight.
Psycho kitty killer.
Qu'est-ce que c'est? Yeah, I don't think Psycho Kitty Killer is hanging out there much. But he's okay. Yeah, Terry's all right.
That's good.
Although, went out this morning into the backyard. Mm-hmm. The gate to the backyard was swinging open.
Was it a ghost?
I don't know what it was. I think it was a guy that came to fix the barn door yesterday. Probably left the gate open. That was about it.
That's good.
But I like to make a lot out of things like that. Claire, the gate's open.
Harrison Mooney yesterday penned an article I want to get your opinion on off the top of the show. By the way, welcome to the Merrick versus Wyszynski podcast. Game show Friday today, by the way, a special edition, Quizmaster Merrick at the helm, and a special contestant, I'd say, as well, for
That's
Game Show
cool.
Friday, plus Dave Medini coming up. Mooney writes, five players that could steal Sidney Crosby's heart. Sidney Crosby, of course, across the board, not only in our predictions, but across the league. The guy everyone thinks is going to win the Art Ross, and the guy a lot of people think is going to win the Hart. Of these names, you tell me. I'm going to name a guy, and you tell me. Give me odds on what you think his Hart Trophy chances are. Okay.
All right.
Alexander Ovechkin.
Oh, I think he may run away with the whole thing. I think he's got the best chance of anybody. I know it's only
Sid.
A 2-game audit. Yep.
Yeah,
I would put him ahead of Sid for Hart Trophy. Yep, absolutely.
Okay, Tell me if you're going to put these guys ahead of Sid. Steven Samuels.
Right. No.
I don't think he'll ever win. As long as Marty San Luis is there, I don't think he'll ever win.
If he scores 70 goals, he's going to win the Hart Trophy.
All right, no, but think about this, right? Like, whatever he scores, Marty's going to get a point on, right? And then when you consider he has San Luis got the captaincy, everyone knows what kind of player he is. Everyone knows he's the heartbeat of that team. I don't see how Stamkos can win the award when Marty's still in the league. Right?
That's fair. But, I mean, Marty's in the back nine of his career, though. Jonathan Drouin is going to be the new
He's the back,
Martin
he's like
San
the back
Louis.
Three of his career. I mean, I'd probably have like 3 years left.
He can see the clubhouse.
Johnny Tavares.
No.
Yeah,
but I can see him winning it one day. I would have given it to him last year, to be honest.
That's an excellent point. I think last year the window was open for him to win.
Yep.
Jonathan Taser Taves. He'll never win the Hart.
You don't think he might win the Hart?
He would have to win it. Here's the thing. He would have to win if Chicago's conditions changed. And let's say there was a year where Kane was injured and Sharp was injured and Taves had to carry the load himself. He'd win it if the Blackhawks sucked for 3 years and all of a sudden managed to make the playoffs and he was the reason why. I don't know if there is a class of player like this. Maybe there is, maybe there isn't. Jonathan Taves is a playoff MVP and not a regular season MVP.
You know who I think of? It's funny. I was having a conversation about this player I'm going to mention yesterday. You know what Jonathan Taves reminds me more of each and every day? Sergei Fedorov. As far as being like the hockey player that all other hockey players look to and say, man, that guy is amazing.
Two-way player.
This guy does. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. This guy more as each year goes on. Now, I don't think he has the skill set that Sergei Fedorov did. No, but when you look at sort of thematically what he does and how he plays and how valuable he is to the team and the respect of peer. Because if you go back, I know everyone, you know, loves Steve Yzerman, even though one of Steve Yzerman's coaches, a significant coach, wink, wink, once said to Mike Ilitch, Mike, if I were you, I would sell Steve Yzerman and buy a pitcher for the Tigers. I can't do anything with this guy. I know everyone loves Steve Yzerman, but, if you ask hockey players, guys that share the ice, who is the better player? Who would they rather have on their team? Who was the guy? They will all tell you, Sergei Fedorov. Hands down. He was magical.
I remember somebody telling me once that there was a bit of internal rivalry between Fedorov and Yzerman. Like there were Fedorov guys and Yzerman guys in that locker room.
Wouldn't surprise me. That's natural. Just like in Montreal when there was, you know, Camp Koivu and Camp Kovalev.
That's a good thing,
surprise me at all.
It's a good thing, I think. I think it's a good thing in Pittsburgh to have two guys like that, two you know, giants of the game in the same locker room. And I'm sure there are Sid guys and Geno guys in that room.
Well, it's funny because the point that I would always look back on when everyone said, okay, the Pittsburgh Penguins have three centermen. They're going to trade one and it's not going to be Crosby. So the decision is, do they trade Malkin or do they trade Staal? The example that I always used was, look at how having Fedorov and Yzerman together fueled both of those guys. Why would you not want the same thing for Pittsburgh? Why would to me the obvious candidate was the one that Ray Shearer moved, and that was Jordan Staal.
Yeah.
Why would you, why in the hell would you mess with a recipe that is so successful? Yzerman to Fedorov, Crosby to Malkin. It's that perfect.
That reminds me, by the way, I just got some coffee before the show and was pouring in a little bit of milk. I flipped the container over, and there was Jordan Stahl's picture. Who knew?
Oh!
Honestly, has a guy fallen off the grid farther than Jordan Staal? And this is not a Carolina thing, mind you. This is simply going from being the guy anointed to be one of the next great centermen. He's a guy who got Taves comparisons based on his skill set with the Penguins. The
guy that was drafted higher than Taves.
Yeah, and now he is a persona non grata. Was he even drafted in our fantasy league?
Oh, yeah, someone took him because I remember I was going to take him and someone grabbed him from me. But it was
later
late. It was
much later round.
It was late, absolutely.
Yeah, it's somebody who's – and when that trade was made, everybody's like, oh, my God, watch out, Staal's together, blah, blah, blah.
He's gone from being the guy behind Sid and Geno to the guy behind his older brother. Like everywhere there's a shadow. Yeah. The two places he's gone, there's been a shadow.
You really forget how much benefit he got from the fact that for like a 2-year span, Sid and Geno were both healthy probably like for 5 games. So getting plum gigs on those Penguins teams and racking up pretty good points. And then all of a sudden you go to Carolina where everybody's healthy, and it's like, nobody's talking about Jordan Staal anymore.
It's weird in Carolina. I keep waiting for them to finally all pull it together, but it's the one team that I look at in the NHL and say, man, there is just, for whatever reason, some players can play with guys, some players can't. There just seems to be chemistry problems. Not talking about dressing room or off ice and that, just on the ice. Like, how long do they try to make Eric Staal work with Jeff Skinner? And it just won't. It just doesn't work.
Well, it's beyond, yeah, and you wonder if it's chemistry problems or just guys not living up to what their reputations portended. I mean, Staal hasn't lived up to it. Skinner is on the path towards, if not Bustville, something along those lines.
I don't know about that. He's a
Calder winner who is now a third liner on that team. Mm-hmm. He's not in the top six.
He is still a very young hockey player. It's weird because we think of players as being, oh man, like you just said, like this guy's on his way to Bustville. How old is Skinner? 22? Like, you're not going to become an actual hockey player until you're 26.
It's the lifespan of an NHL player. He should be a Hall of Famer by now, based on his previous trajectory.
It's weird.
About it, but you have to admit that guys who won the Calder go, this guy is not matured in the same trajectory as like a Patrick Kane.
He was best in his class that year, but the second step hasn't been there yet for Jeff Skinner. No. And some of that just might be physical too.
The last name on the Harrison Mooney list was Erik Karlsson, as far as winning the Hart instead of Sid.
Nope.
You don't think
I still
so?
I still want to see him play a season after that horrible injury. Because the guy that we saw last year in the playoffs wasn't Erik Karlsson. I want to see if this guy's fully healed.
Oh, right?
And even by his admission. Show me.
Is there anybody else on your radar that could win the Hart beyond those players that we've just mentioned? I mean, obviously, it's much like the Jack Adams. Sometimes teams that aren't expected to make the playoffs that make the playoffs and a guy has a monster year. Sometimes teams that win their division and a guy has a monster year. I mean, of those players we just mentioned, what about Kessel?
No.
Kessel be in that mix?
Nope. Unless he's popping in 60 goals, but that,
I'll tell you
I don't
who would
that's
be in
going
the
to
mix.
Happen.
I'll tell you who would be in
that
mix.
Mikhail Grabowski? Oh, no, Ovechkin's going to split both of them.
Claude Giroux.
What?
Dude, if the Flyers make the playoffs with that goaltending, and Drew
I see what you mean. Yeah, and that blue line, and that blue
and he
line,
and he has a 90-point season, he can win the Hart.
Hmm. You know who's, you know who I think is going to be the John Tavares one day, the guy that's sort of, okay, he's knocking on the door of greatness, and one day it's just going to all come together because he's ready to take that next step. And you're going to love this because you love this team. Logan Couture.
Sure. That's a possibility.
Logan Couture,
but
Logan Couture could be what John Tavares was last year.
See, I was thinking about the direct Tavares comparison, which would be a team that's kind of shitty, and then they make the playoffs, and then the best young player on that team makes the cut and wins the heart. Of that ilk?
Nazem Kadri?
He was in the discussions back when he was point per game last season.
Remember when he was top 10 last year, and we're all saying, Nazem Kadri's going to compete for the Hart Trophy? Like, for a month there, we were having that discussion. Think about that for a sec.
I guess that would mean either Huberto or Barkov might be in line for it when the Panthers make the playoffs. Let's see here. Let me ask you this. Who do you think on that roster?
Which one?
On the Edmonton roster.
Yep.
Which guy do you think wins a major award first? Be it the Hart, be it a scoring title, be it... Let's throw the Selke in there if you wanted to, although I don't know who would win the Selke in that collection. Who do you think wins a major award first?
Taylor Hall. Taylor Hall is ready to take the next step.
And
superstardom. What? If the Oilers make it, it's going to be because of players like Taylor Hall. And specifically that player, as long as he stays healthy. The problem with Taylor Hall is the way he plays. It's a weird problem if you're a coach. Wow, we have a guy that goes to the net too hard. Are you kidding? There's 30 coaches that wish they had players that went to the net as hard as Taylor Hall does. I can see Taylor Hall being the guy that distinguishes himself from all those players. Mm-hmm. From Eberle, from Gagne, from Hopkins to Yakupov, all of them.
I'll take Nugent Hopkins and the Art Ross.
Really, eh?
Yeah.
Not Taylor Hall.
Eventually, well, the thing about, though, is that when you get a center, then all of a sudden you get a guy who's going to have his hand in on a lot of that offense.
Did a centerman win the Art Ross last year?
Well, no, but...
Oh, God.
I
know
what
you
really
mean.
Make me do this shit. Here we go.
No, I'm not.
Because you had to go and pull your little example out of your ass, and now I have to go back and look at the winners.
You're right.
A winger won it last year, and a winger won it 2 years ago, or 3 years ago. But then Malkin, Henrik Sedin, Malkin, winger, in OV. Center, winger. Well, actually, you know what? I'll give you this. When the winger is either Marty St. Louis or Jaromír Jágr, then those guys win the Art Ross. But when the center is, let me just bring it all the way back. It's an impossible argument to make because of the existence of Jágr, Gretzky, and Lemieux from 1980 through 1997. Either Gretzky, Lemieux, or Jágr for 1 year won the Art Ross. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you just have to take a step back and realize what incredible runs it were for Gretzky and Mario.
Okay, let me ask you this question.
Go ahead, please.
I don't know if I've ever posited this as a question to you before. Did we just see, in that era, did we just see the golden age of centers or the golden age of goaltenders?
In which era?
In the Gretzky, Lemieux, Jágr era.
So from what would be the era? From 1980 through 2000, like a 20-year era?
No, I'd say the centers have a head start on that era because the three goaltenders are going to cite are all essentially 90s guys. Or did we transition from the era of the golden era of centers? Because you throw, Dale Hawerchuk into that mix as well, Mark Messier, Steve Yzerman, Sergei Fedorov. Did that then transition to the golden age of goaltenders where we saw three of the greatest of all time? Three you could legitimately put in the top five of all time.
Who are your three?
Dominic Hasek, Patrick Roy, and Martin Brodeur.
Right. I would say
the outside of that is Eddie Belfour.
But Hasek, Brodeur were clearly the 1990s though.
Yep, that's what I mean. The centers have a head start.
Yeah, the centers are probably the previous decade, then you go to the goalies after that. And Belfour's in that mix. Who else would be in that mix?
Cujo? No. Nope. No. Not in the elite. He was very good, but not in elite. Those are the three, and Belfour is sort of on the fringes of that.
Rank the Roy Brodeur Hasek trio for me.
Oh Jesus, I hate this. You prick. I would go. See, it's a. I hate to do that. Well, it depends on whether it's a one game winner take all or a series or
let's
a season.
Let's do it this way. Let's do it this way. We'll do two versions of it. Building a all team, right. And game seven of the finals.
Building a team, Marty Brodeur. Game seven of the finals, Dominic Hasek.
That's so funny. I'd go the complete opposite.
You would, eh?
Yeah, building a team, Dominic Hasek, and then
so
Marty
hang on,
Brodeur.
Hang on. The guy with angel hair past the groin. You're gonna build your team around?
Yes, over the guy who who's the majority of his career was built upon having a system and a Hall of Fame defenseman.
You
and
can't
I'll even,
fault him. You can't
I'll even
fault
acknowledge
him for
that as a Devils fan, right? Like, wow, I think Marty's fantastic, and I think Marty, as I've often said, is a victim of Joe Montana disease, where, you know, sometimes people rank Montana behind Dan Marino and John Elway when they talk about great quarterbacks because Elway and Marino both did more with less. But you have to credit Montana for making that system work and getting the most out of the talent that surrounded him. And Marty made the system work. Other goalies have tried to play the system. They weren't as good. His skill set was perfect for it, and overall is an elite goaltender. But if I had to start a team, I'd pick Hasek because Hasek could do something that I think Wah and Brodeur didn't do as well, which is win a game on his own.
Here's why Marty worked. Because you know what the New Jersey Devils system, which was built around that defense and that goaltender, you know what it was? From Marty's point of view, give me the shot. Give me the shot, and you take away everything around the shot. But I want that one-on-one challenge. That's
right.
What, like, if you look at two-on-ones, look at the last 15 years of the New Jersey Devils. What happens on two-on-ones? What does a defenseman do? Gives Marty the shot.
Yep.
Just takes away everything around him. Mm-hmm. Takes away the second guy on the two-on-one. Make sure the guy coming back high. The guy coming in high, rather, he's covered as well. Marty wanted the shot. Give me the shot.
And the benefit of the system to Marty was that sometimes he wouldn't even have the shot. I mean, I wonder how many games in his career were sub-20 shot games.
Oh, God, tons. I remember there was one Leaf game that was like Leafs threw seven pucks at him.
Yeah.
It may have been the most boring game I ever witnessed in my life, but.
Well, hey, that's Devils hockey, baby. You know, what's interesting about, that though is that if you've asked him, and I've asked him in the past, like, he wants more shots. Like, it's hard to, it's one of the greatest things about Brodeur that's never talked about is that focus. And people always talk about the trap as being a benefit to his career and this, that, and the other thing. Do you know how hard it is for a goalie to stand there without a single shot on goal for 10 minutes?
Wish I could listen. One of the things that I can't figure out, you know, whenever there's a goaltending change, the mantra is always, "Oh, he's been sitting down. Throw as many pucks at him as possible." My opinion is a complete 180 to that, which is, hang on. So the guy's been sitting for a period and a half. He's cold. Why are we letting him warm up? Why are we throwing everything we can at him? Why don't we wait for the perfect shot? He's cold. Why are we trying to heat him up? Why don't we just leave him like that and wait for the perfect shot?
Right.
No, pass more. Get him, you know, move it around. Don't let him get a feel for the puck. I could never understand, oh, here comes a new goaltender. Oh, they're going to start peppering him. Why? Why would you do that? Why would you let him get a feel for the puck?
Yep.
Why?
Yep. That's a good point.
Just throw a bunch of pucks from the outside. Stupid.
Let me see here. Reshek writes in, if you factor in the systems they were in, Hasek, Wah, Brodeur. Wah gets way too much credit for because people don't remember that Montreal was not fire wagon. Montreal was as much of a systems team as the Devils were.
Yeah.
And he played behind. It wasn't, if you're going to say Marty was a product of Stevens and Niedermeyer, well, it wasn't like Patrick Wah was playing behind J.J. Daniel the entire time.
No, I know. He had some. I mean, 93, Eric Desjardins was. Pretty good defense.
Pretty
good
defense.
And you had one of the premier, you know, two-way players in the game. A guy by the name of, Guy Carboneau. And an entire system sort of predicated on defense first and opportunistic scoring. Let's grind out 2-1, 3-1 games. That's what it was.
I'm checking something right now. So Wah's first Vezina was in 88-89, right?
Okay. That's when his first Vezina was? Okay, yeah. Because he came in 86 as a rookie.
Right.
And don't forget, much like Marty early on, I mean, Marty early was, you know, pretty bad. I can recall, you know, did I ever tell you the Larry Robinson story, the sauna story with Patrick Roy?
Hey, before you get there, and you mentioned Larry Robinson, 88, 89, here amongst the defensemen in front, that played in front of Patrick Roy, Chris Chelios, Craig Ludwig,
who blocked the original shot blocker, yep.
Yeah, Peter Svoboda, Larry Robinson, Eric Desjardins.
Yeah. Yeah, I know.
There was a real, it was like wet tissue paper in front of Patrick Roy when he played.
Imagine this scene. This is heading into the playoffs, 1986. And Patrick Roy is, you know, the new goaltender on the scene, called up from Sherbrooke of the American Hockey League. You know, the next great French Canadian goaltender, the new Jacques Plante, the savior in Montreal, even though he grew up as a Nordiques fan. He was always prone to letting in one bad goal a game, and it would crush the spine of the Montreal Canadiens. And they knew it, but they're heading into the playoffs, and someone
Bakov disease.
That's a great example too. So the Montreal Canadiens are having their sauna. So imagine the hockey team just wrapped in towels, having their steam. Larry Robinson walks in. Everybody stands up and walks out, except for Patrick, because he's not in on it. So they all leave. It's like a scene from The Godfather, right? So Robinson sits down next to Patrick Roy in the sauna and turns to him and says, in a really angry voice, "No more bad effing goals," and stands up and walks out. And there's this rookie sitting there in his towel in the sauna as one of the greatest defensemen to ever play the game just told him, "No more bad effing goals." And that was the message from Larry Robinson. And you know what? Good for him, because he won the Stanley Cup that year with the Montreal Canadiens. It worked. That right there is leadership, young man. That right there is leadership.
All right. Game show Friday coming up. A question of the day, by the way. As you may have seen, the Tortorella era has begun for the Vancouver Canucks. And that means that some players are blocking shots, and other players aren't blocking shots. So the question of the day is, what? How? When, why, how will John Tortorella get the Sedins to block a shot? PuckDaddyBlock@yahoo.com. @Wyshynski@JeffMerrick on Twitter.
How many shots did they block? They blocked yesterday with their debut with the John Tortorella system, by the way.
That'd be a goose egg.
That would be nothing. Zero.
Okay. How will John Tortorella get the Sedins to block shots? PuckDaddyBlock@yahoo.com. @Wyshynski@JeffMerrick on Twitter. #NVSW.
Also, if you indicate... at which game? Is it game 5? Is it game 10? Is it game 13? Is it game 20? One of the Sedins actually blocks a shot. We should have a pool, Wish. We actually have a Sedin pool for shot blocking. When do they block their first shot? And who is it? Is it Hendrick or Daniel?
Let's see here. It'll be Daniel.
And do they, when Daniel blocks a shot, does Hendrick feel it as well?
Yes.
Classic Corsican brothers? Daniel goes down to block a shot, and all of a sudden, Henrik drops.
Brian Azalius writes in, don't warm up the goalie. One of the best points I've heard from this podcast. One of the few theories, not crackpot, from Jeff Merrick.
wait till I drop my Patrick Roy theory on you from what happened 2 nights ago. I got a new one. I got a total new one.
All right. We have Dave Bedini coming up, but we also have to hear the Patrick Roy theory. And with that, let's start the show proper, shall we?
Okay.
He's Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet.
Don't you give the guy a little bit of rope this year?
No.
What's give him no point? Rope. No rope. You want to see the guy that flops? He's, you know, the Faith No More video. That's the guy you want to see.
Are you kidding? Babcock's going to Bilesma this sucker.
Oh, yes. My Dick Tracy like good looks. Yes.
The gentleman's parlor.
And Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
I don't know if you know, but the Atlantic Division has been renamed as the Metropolitan Division. You have any thoughts about that?
Is it really?
Yeah.
He's a top-line player for the Carolina Hurricanes, and I still think of his schwanz when I hear that name. I don't want to take a shit on the Devils. Rangers fans do that every day for me.
Debate hockey.
Can someone please break it to Phil? He's very sensitive. They always boo him in Boston.
This High Sticking Review brought to you by...
Well, listen, we're having
Cialis.
A debate.
Cialis, there it is.
We're having a
brought
debate.
Brought to you by Hernan Pills.
We're having High Sticking. We're having a debate, and this dissension is sponsored by Doritos.
Pop culture.
He's wound so tight, all right? Like Cameron Fry, the Ferris Bueller's Day Off, Lump of Coal, the Diamond. If he's wound that tight on the day of an exhibition game, probably not a good time to be wound.
Not a good time to be
wound. Not a good time to be
wound. No.
Merrick versus Wyshynski.
91-92, the defenseman that Patrick Roy had in front of him included, this is also a Vezina year for him. The defenseman included such names as Eric Desjardins, J.J. Daigneau, Lyle Odelein, Matthew Schneider, Peter Svoboda, Sylvain Lefebvre, Patrick and Patrice Brisebois.
It's pretty good.
Also in Colorado, I picked 96-97 when he led the league in wins.
Hmm. Adam Foote. Were they good then, too?
Adam Foote, Uwe Krupp. And then Curtis Lecision.
Mm-hmm.
But then you get, you know, Sandro Lynch, Alexei Gusarov, and then, of course, Aaron Miller and John Klem. So some outliers.
Krupp was a Stanley Cup winning goal for kind of love. Hey, our guest is standing by, and I can't wait to get to him. You want to get to him there, Wish?
Go ahead, sir.
He is a true Canadian Renaissance man. He does it all. You like your art, you like your sports, you have to like Dave Bedini. He is a musician, he is a writer with the National Post, he is an author as well. His latest offering, Keon and Me, available through Viking Books. Dave Bedini joins us now to talk about the enigmatic Dave Keon, who still refuses to come back to the Maple Leafs organization. Dave, how are you today, bud?
Hello, fellows. How are you guys doing?
Hey, Dave Bedini, I saw that Torontoist called you the quintessential Canadian. Can you explain what that means for an American?
I don't know. Well, quintessential is 5 points, is that right? I'm the five-pointed Canadian. I don't know. You know, you don't have quintessential Americans?
I always thought that it just meant you came from the Bay of Quinte, so you're on the Belleville area, Dave.
We used to call that the Bay of Quincy. And there used to be a cabin when we would gig between Peterborough and Kingston.
Mm-hmm.
Up into the Bay of Quincy. Oh, we got up to some no good.
Oh, my goodness. Okay. I can imagine that, a Canadian rock band doing that. Hey, before we get to Keon and Me, an excellent offering, certainly. I want to get, we're talking a lot about Patrick Roy the last couple of days for the obvious reasons. What did you make of the antics from a couple of nights ago?
It's funny. I was on CBC a couple of years ago, Q Radio, which is a big mm-hmm. show here, and I think that you can get it in the States, Greg, on satellite. But Patrick Roy was rumored to be, I think when there was a Habs vacancy, and I suggested that it would be insane to hire Patrick Roy to coach the Habs because Patrick Roy himself is kind of insane. And I was kind of shouted down at the time, but Jesus, one game? like, he couldn't have maybe waited till it was a midweek in February, Tuesday nighter. Yeah. So, listen, I think it's hilarious and kind of awesome. I mean, I'm not an Avs fan. We're on the other side of the country. But it's going to be, you know, you could feed this into the whole argument about fighting in a way. I think we could all do with a return of the wild man, right? Every night's going to be throwback night in Colorado, I think, with the way he's running his bench. You love to see coaches peek out because they peek out so different from players in a way. It's going to be fun. What'd you guys think?
Well, you know, you bring up an interesting point that we didn't really cover, which is that he set the bar kind of high.
I mean, right,
debut
exactly.
game one of the season. It makes you think that he's going to be – I mean, there's a very good chance he's going to shoot Joel Quenneville through the eye with a harpoon at some point.
That's
because
right.
That's the only place he can go after doing what he did with the glass.
Right. He'll be wearing a quiver, right, in his next – there'll be suction arrows, right? So it'll just be – you know, the theater of Patrick – the Gallic Theater of Patrick Roy. Right? It's going to be beautiful. It's kind of going to be beautiful.
That's a good point, Greg, because last time I checked, you know, Lynyrd Skynyrd never opened up with Freebird, to my knowledge. He kind of build to it, but he, you know, he sort of blew his works all the first shot.
There's that great line from, you know, the Larry Sanders Show when Hank finally gets – he's hosting, he's doing his own theatrical performance or whatever, and he tells Larry, he says, you know, we start with spin and wheel. It's a real showstopper. And Larry says to Mank, you never open with the showstopper. Right?
Yeah, but honestly, Dave, when your restaurant's revolving, as Hank's Look Around Cafe was, there's really no reason why you can't start with the showstopper.
That's a good point.
As a Canadian, Dave, like every other Canadian, myself included, we wring our hands and nitpick hockey to death. Anything bugging you about the game these days?
No, not at all. I mean, you know, the elephant in the room is obviously, you know, something everybody's been talking about and stuff. But no, I mean, I think the game's been really good the last few years, and I was on the outside looking in for a long time, and I was as critical as anybody. But I think the game has been replenished with a lot of, you know, some of the most extraordinary. You see kids, you know, players at 18 now are just so much more capable, so much more interesting. Even, you know, I was at the Worlds in Stockholm, and I got a chance to see players that I don't normally see, like Matt Duchene and Stamkos and Piqué Subban and Ryan O'Reilly, and the list goes on, you know, relatively young players. And their just ability to cover the ice and do everything so well. And I think, you know, the game falls at, you know, at their heels. And I think they've just, you know, they've done a great job kicking the ball and moving the game forward. I think it's a pretty thrilling game.
It is a thrilling game, but the elephant in the room obviously is still
right.
on its hind legs braying right now. The fighting issue has become so prevalent in the last couple of weeks. And my question to you is, what do you think about the notion that instead of an outright ban, they just make sure that there isn't that second fight like we saw with Peros and Colton Orr? You know, if you give a guy a game misconduct for fighting, it does ensure that you're not going to get round two. It seems to be an idea that at least has some traction. What do you think about that?
My personal opinion is that the theme of fighting has created so much white noise in our sport, so much like radiostatic and interference, that a lot of the true narrative, some of the stronger narratives and some of the more interesting narratives of the game get completely lost because we're all so busy talking about it and debating and arguing this issue front and center. This won't ever happen, but I think the best thing for the sport and the best thing for that issue right now is to game misconducts for a year or for a trial period, game misconducts, fighting you're out, just so the argument can be laid to rest. Then we'll find out whether, in fact, the rats flourish, the cheap shots flourish, the sticks get up, the game disintegrates without the presence of fighters, without, you know, pugilists, enforcers in the game. Because nobody really knows. Like, one side is saying that the game will be completely corrupted if you don't have this presence on the ice, and the other half is saying it will be completely freed and it will be this beautiful thing, but nobody really knows. So whether that means trying it at the AHL level or another level of hockey, I think it's come to the point now where we have to know, because and then it will be easier to make a decision or try to figure out some sort of solution about the game.
See, here's my issue with the automatic game misconduct for a fight. If I know that I can get player X out of the game by drawing him into a fight, I am doing whatever I can, legal or otherwise, to try to get him to do that. Or
right.
I'm just grabbing someone on the ice, starting to punch him, knowing I'm going to draw someone else into that fight to protect that player, much like we saw with David Clarkson jumping in to save Phil Kessel, and that will get that player off the ice.
Sure.
Like if I'm a 2 minute a night goon, I'm doing my job if I take someone of significance off the ice with me.
Right.
That's why I think it becomes more dangerous. In a lot of ways, you could actually make the argument that the 5 minute penalty for fighting actually makes it safer.
Sure, but Jeff, you have to agree that we're arguing in hypotheticals here.
Absolutely, right? Absolutely, so, absolutely, completely true.
Yeah,
but I just don't think that the culture of this game right now is at a point where if you take away, you know, the John Scotts, just to cite an example, if you take away the John Scotts, that intimidation will no longer be part of the game, because I think it still will.
Dave, do you think that? Are you a guy who listens to the players speak on this issue and say, okay, I'm going to err on the side of what the guys that are on the ice say? Or are you a guy that says, if the guys on the ice had their druthers, there wouldn't be helmets? I mean, do you kind of like, you know what I mean?
Yeah, no, and listen, I 100% believe that, yeah, the players, the ex-players, the GMs, the presidents, that hockey world has to have the final say. They know the game. Knowing the game at ice level or on the ice is not like knowing the game in any other way. You know, it's fine for me and all of us here and other people, you know, critics of the game, or not even critics, observers of the game, to talk about it. But until you're in that swarm, until you're in, you know, at the heart of the game, you know, whether it's you're in the middle of a fight that breaks out or what, but you can never know the game until you know it at ice level. So I have to defer to them. So If I do get in an argument, say, you know, with somebody about fighting the role of fighting, I don't really know. I don't know what it's like to, you know, to taste that kind of that bloody sort of salty intoxicant that you get when you're in that position. Truly, they know because they've been in, you know, they've been in, at the heart of it and stuff. So I really do think it does fall to them. And that, I think, is partly what's interesting about what Jim Rutherford and Steve Yzerman and Scotty Bowman have been saying, because it's the first time it's not Damian Cox. It's not, you know, other advocates for getting fighting out of the game. It's the players, ex-players and the management themselves.
Dave, big night tonight at the Royal, because you are launching Keon and Me, another excellent hockey offering from Dave Bedini. How much did, because I just caught the tail end of his NHL, actually, I watched Dave Keon more in the WHA when he played for the Fighting Saints and the Whalers and the Racers than I did playing for the Toronto Maple Leafs, because that was right when I was becoming a hockey fan in like the 74,
right.
75
he
era.
Those, he shows up in those goon reels every now and then kind of skating through the frame, right?
Yeah, exactly. I'm out of here. I got nothing to do with this. Still though, to this day, if anyone ever asked me who's got the best backhander you ever saw,
well, yeah,
hands down, Dave Keon was the guy. Why did Dave Keon hold this special part in Dave Bedini's hockey heart?
Yeah, Keon was the first person for me, the first human being who I would have been able to identify beyond my mom and dad and sister. Basically, he was the first person that I was aware of because of his presence on the team. It's funny, you know, it's really, I think, very, very difficult in a way for younger generations, we'll say, and new fans to comprehend what it meant in the late 60s and early 70s to be the captain of the Toronto Maple Leafs, better than being prime minister, more significant than being prime minister. If you were the captain of the Toronto Maple Leafs, you were the shit. And Keon was that. And Keon, in my time, when I became aware of this game, you know, my awakening in terms of, you know, being aware that this game existed, this team existed, the importance of this team in the city, he was the guy, because he was connected to the glory days of the team, mm-hmm. you know, from the 50s right up through the 60s. He was the dude, and he'd survived. He'd crossed across these decades, the hairstyles, right? The chronological hairstyles as they evolve. You know, Keon with kind of the greaser Stomp and Tom look in the beginning to the dark sideburns, right? And he was our link to those times. And you know, he also looking back, the most decorated Maple Leaf ever. You know, two Lady Bangs, four Stanley Cups, Conn Smythe and Calder. When you were down by a goal, you wanted him on the ice, and when you were up by a goal, you wanted him on the ice. He played against all the team's best centers, the complete two-way player, and in one fight, his entire NHL career. And that was something that was significant to me as well, because my parents would always say, if you're going to play hockey, if you're going to play sports, you're going to do it like Dave Keon. He plays it the right way.
Did you ever see the Greg Shepherd fight?
There's no tape of the Greg Shepherd. I haven't seen it. Have you seen it?
No, I never have.
No,
It exists in this mythical the Dave Keon's fight. Yeah. It's like,
if you haven't
Rob
seen
Ford.
It, sir.
It's like the Rob Ford crack tape, you know?
That's right.
Is it out?
Right.
Who knows?
Right. Except nobody had to die for it.
Well, that's so weird, because this Somalian guy tried to offer me the Shepherd fight tape,
right,
and I...
Right, of course. That's funny, but no, that, and in a way, you know, it kind of, the fact that it doesn't exist for me as a writer is almost, it's almost kind of more poetic, right? Because I'm able to sort of dream up, imagine the scene as it all went down, and other players, McKennie talking a little bit about it, and everybody has a different version of kind of how it all went down.
Well, the interesting thing, like you mentioned in another interview, you mentioned that the way the Leafs have approached Dave Keon, Or not approach them, I should say.
Yeah,
is akin to the Boston Red Sox not acknowledging Ted Williams, not acknowledging a guy who is considered to be the heart and soul in the history of the franchise. How is it possible that there's not more consistent outrage about this?
I think it's almost become entrenched now in the culture. I'm sort of trying to spark the outrage, I suppose, and not even the outrage, but just the kind of the concern and care. over the fact that you sit in the Air Canada Center and you look up in those banners and he's absent. It's egregious and obnoxious. And there were overtures at one point were made to him during the right before the closing of Maple Leaf Gardens, in which a form letter was sent to Dave Keown, dear former player. But yeah, that's not what you do. You know, I think you have to treat players on an individual basis, but really what you have to do is you have to get the boys on the private jet, and if you head down to West Palm and you have to hang out in the patio and you got to kill a couple of bottles of rye and you got to smoke some cigars and you got to get down to brass tacks, you got to make them feel welcome, right? Because he was a special player, was a particular player. And Tim Leiwicki, you know, has gone on record saying he wants to get rid of all the old photos in the rink, and now he's kind of done a 180 because Johnny Bauer kicked his ass, and it falls to him. It falls to Tim Leiwicki to engineer this. And the whole, you know, company policy with the Leafs not retiring sweaters, rather honoring their sweaters, just retire the goddamn sweater. George Armstrong's not going to care. Johnny Bauer's not going to care. Ace Bailey's dead. It's not, Wendell's not going to care whether you honor 14, and they should honor 14 because he was the greatest Maple Leaf to ever play.
And it was always weird every time I'd see Matt Stajan skating around with, in my mind, Dave Keon's number. It always, it always just looked a little bit askew. Now the issue, see, here's, I can't get my head around where Dave Keown is at vis-a-vis the Toronto Maple Leafs, because his issue was with Ballard. That was the issue. MLSE. It's not, well, you know, the consortium of Rogers and Bell. The issue was with Ballard.
Yes. But he felt that those who followed, and even I'm thinking back to Dryden days, he didn't feel that they were making an effort really beyond. Yeah, Ballard cut him off at the knees, and Ballard tried to desecrate him in the city.
Yep.
But in his mind, the subsequent ownership wasn't a lot. He thought they were just typical because of the gesture that they made, or lack thereof.
It's interesting too, because, you know, the final act, the Maple Leafs had the rights, you know, refusing to trade him to the New York Islanders because, right, Harold was holding out for one more first round draft pick, and the player the Islanders ended up getting, the final piece of their puzzle, was Butch Goring, and then they went on to their four Stanley Cup, you know, parade, and that was, right, Dave Keon's like last shot at winning the cup.
Right, and you talked to Brian Trottier about that, and he remembers when the rumors started to circulate that Keon was coming to the Islanders.
Yep.
He'll tell you how, right, excited the whole room was. You know, because all of those kids on that team, for them, Keon was he was their idol. So, you know, not only did Ballard deprive him, you know, going to a team that was, you know, on this kind of upward swing, but he would have felt probably more welcome in that room than he'd ever felt, or he felt in a long time in a Leaf dressing room. And that's sad.
I only have one more for you, sir. I wanted to get your take on Philip Kessel, who, of course, will be a Leaf for the next 8 years plus, mm-hmm, $8 million a season. Definitely someone who has seen his reputation change, I think, within the last calendar year. But what's your take on Phil Kessel, $8 million man?
I don't think the dollar figures just don't bother me anymore. I mean, especially where, you know, where they're thrown, money is just thrown around so freely in this league. I think probably the timing is good. I mean, I don't think you'd want there to be any kind of, there's a sort of freshness. You know, listen, Leaf fans are strolling in the meadows right now, and we could be attacked by a plague of locusts at any moment. So I think it's the right time. And I think if you can kind of, you know, it's feel good. I think if they can kind of ride on this sweetness a little bit. But is he worth the $8 million? I think he probably is. Anytime anybody signed to that kind of contract, you never really know. It's like what the Chinese say about, you know, you never can really understand the times you live in until like a century has passed. So we'll, mm-hmm, be able to know in 10, 15 years whether this was the right kind of signing. But right now we don't know. Although I think for most people it just sort of feels okay. So I'm not troubled by it at all.
Dave, last one here from this microphone. Your chance to promo tonight, because it's going to be, this looks like a fantastic evening, because not only is it the book launch for Keon and me, but,
right,
a couple of people that I really dig, Stephen Stanley of Lowest of the Low, and someone that we had on the podcast last year and everyone has enjoyed his work for a number of years, Tim Thompson, is going to be presenting a selection of Hockey Night in Canada montages at the Royal tonight with you.
Yeah, it's going to be great. You know, the openings, we'll probably screen three or four of Tim's openings. We're going to do the Neil Young one, the Radiohead one, and a couple of others. That the one actually that he and I did to open the 60th season of Hockey Night in Canada last year. So yeah, they're going to sound great and they're going to look beautiful on the screen. Steve's going to sing 14 and Me, which is a song he wrote about Dave Keown that we performed at Hockey Day in Canada 2 years ago in PEI, which was largely the impetus for the book. I'm going to read. It's at the theater, the cinema, where my dad used to go watch movies when he was a kid.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, and the book is largely about me as an 11-year-old Leaf fan, and my son is 11. So, yeah, it's a really, yeah, it's going to be a great night.
Hey, make sure you come to our opening as well. Merrick's going to show old VHS copies of Rock'em Sock'em, and I'm going to make fart noises. So it's pretty
that's
good.
That's the difference between us and the artist on the phone here, Greg. That's main
right.
difference. The event tonight, doors open at 7 o'clock. It is at 608 College Street if you're living in Toronto or the GTA. Dave, best of luck with the book. Best of luck tonight. We'll probably see you on the ice before I see you anywhere else.
So we'll talk
to you soon.
Right on. Okay, great. Thanks so much, guys.
Thanks,
Dave Bedini, Canadian Renaissance man. He's got, like, honestly, like, of all the people in Canada, he has carved himself out one of the most interesting niches in that, you know, he's able to go between, you know, being the leader of Bedini Band, formerly the Rio Statics, my favorite band of all time, and, you know, do a weekly column in the National Post, where he sort of has carte blanche topic-wise to do whatever he wants, to writing books, to traveling, to making documentaries. The Hockey Nomad Goes to Russia is one of the best, for my money, hockey yeah. documentaries you're ever going to see. He's really he I can honestly tell you, there is no one in Canada, Greg, quite like Dave Bedini. There is no one like him. There's not even anyone close to doing what Bedini does. And he approaches, you know, like, there's always been that divide between, you know, art and sports. And he pays the same type of respect to both and lives in both worlds as well. Like, he's at ease talking to you and me about fighting and Patrick Waugh and the history of hockey as he is talking to, you know, he mentioned that radio program Q from CBC, talking to Gian Gomeschi. Like, there's no different, and he's not a different guy in each venue.
And the difference is that when guys that aren't considered to be sports writers dip into sports sometimes, it could be transforming the subject into something political or something,
agenda-driven.
And the thing that Bedini does is he approaches it as a fan and really kind of makes it, covers it in a way that I think is a way where you want him to continue to do it. And
yeah,
not necessarily say, okay, your vacation's over, go do what you normally do. Dennis Seidenberg, 4x4 contract with the Boston Bruins. I think this is actually a really, really good contract for both sides.
Hell yeah. It's fan. He has become one of the best, you know, sort of sneaky good players. You know, we always talk about Louis Erickson as being, he's the most underrated player in hockey, right? Wouldn't you throw Dennis Seidenberg into that equation? Like, when you talk about underrated players, don't you throw Seidenberg right in there? Like, the moment he got out from under the weight that was the Florida Panthers and into a market where people could actually notice what he was doing, mm-hmm. all of a sudden Seidenberg became one of the best sneaky good defensemen you will see. Dude cleans up in his own zone. Dude blocks shots. I mean, how quickly, let me give you this example. When the Boston Bruins made the trade for Thomas Cabrelle and realized, we can't use him anywhere and we can't even use him on the power play. Who got that spot? Dennis Seidenberg. Mm-hmm. Like, I think he's one of the best sneaky good players in the NHL.
He was atrocious in the final last year against the Blackhawks, but he admitted after the postseason that he had
injured
his hamstring in the Leafs series. So, yeah, yeah. And the Bruins doing a really good job knowing where their bread is buttered, keeping that defense together, although it'll be interesting to see what they do. Boychuk and McQuaid, I think, are both up in 2 years, so it'll be interesting to see what they do there.
McQuaid, the new age Candanico?
The new age Candanico, right. Well, because now you're talking about Chara and Seidenberg signed, Boychuk and McQuaid up in two, and then you've got Krug and Hamilton in the mix. So is that your six, or is someone going to try to – it would not surprise me in the least, especially in Boychuk's case, to see someone try to poach him with a big contract.
Yeah, I can see that happening. Attention, by the way, alert, my bit rate just dropped from 26.4 to 24. So
you don't
heads
sound
up.
Any different, though. But you don't sound any different.
Okay, good. To me. Good. I probably should have emailed you the Game Show Friday questions.
And just in case?
Just in case.
I'll tell you what. If something happens to you and you drop off, I will just make up a bunch of questions for our guest. Real quick before we get the game show, though, a couple of answers. How will John Tortorella convince Henrik and Daniel to block a shot? Mike from Attleboro writes in, threatened to trade them both to Patrick Waugh.
That's good. That's
a pretty good answer.
That's a good one. Yep.
Amongst the other answers here, how will Schwartz get the boys to block his shots? Ken writes in, convince them that it's easier to draw penalties in the defensive zone. The diving will commence and the shot blocking will take care of itself. That has been, there's been several variations of that joke, but I do enjoy that one a lot. Matthew Toy writes in, Tortorella will threaten to make them watch the non-Swedish version of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo after each practice. I freely admit, much to my dismay, I never got around to seeing the Daniel Craig version of The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, which is an affront to my cinemaphile nature because I'm a huge David Fincher fan, but I never got around to seeing that film.
Even I've seen that film.
Is it good?
Claire and I watched it in the hotel room. Yeah, it was fantastic. I loved it. But what do I know from movies?
One of the
I thought it was great.
One of the single greatest trailers of all time, by the way, which was a cover by the, I believe it was the Yeah Yeah Yeahs of Immigrant Song by Led Zeppelin. And it was a bunch of like really quick cut images. It was an amazing, amazing trailer.
Is that one of those songs that's impossible to get wrong? Is it just such a great song that no matter who covers it, it's always going to be good? Kind of like Kashmir. You know, actually, when you think about it, a lot of those Zeppelin songs.
Well, hold on.
A lot of Zeppelin songs. What?
Kashmir was somewhat covered by Puff Daddy.
Yeah, I didn't mind that.
Soundtrack.
I didn't mind that version.
Oh,
I know.
Terrible.
It was, you know what? The song is so good, still totally with it.
Invalidates right. Your argument on Kashmir. I'll give you Immigrant Song, but no, irrefutable evidence that that song could be ruined.
All right, fine. Okay, Gordon Perkins submits, Torts won't get the Sedins to block a shot on purpose ever. They only block shots if it's off target.
Ryan Thomas writes, Torts will convince the Sedins to block a shot by telling them they can build bunk beds in the dressing room, freeing up space for more activities.
Wow. Ed Gorsensky, pretend the shot is like a Brad Marchand punch and just stand there and take it. Oh, that's nasty. Oh, man. You guys are nasty today.
And
it's Friday. Relax.
This is a somewhat serious one from Josh P. before we get to Game Show Friday and Frivolity. Torts will show them his Stanley Cup ring. One of the cornerstones of that Lightning team that won the Cup was blocking shots. There's nothing the Sedins want more than to win a Cup, and if Torts convinces them that shot blocks will lead them there, they may get the whole team on board. And if that doesn't work, he can show them his sweet ankle tattoo he got after winning the Cup. So there you go. I mean, there is a certain right. notion that you have a guy who's won, and maybe that's enough to convince these guys how to play the game the way he wants them to.
Where is your dart land? Which game do they block their first shot?
I say Daniel blocks one in game three.
Game three, eh? Yep. I'll take the over on that, sir.
Okay.
I'm saying game five.
I say game two.
Yeah, game five, they block
after three. After game two, one of the reporters in Vancouver will come up to Torts and say, when do you expect the Sedins to block a shot? And Torts will say, you know, we got to get Danny, we got to get Henrik really blocking shots. We need him out there. We need to get some jam in this lineup. And then by game three, Daniel will do it.
I can't wait to see the first shot block. It's going to be so special. It's going to be a where were you moment. Hey, we better get to game show. You know why? Because if my bitrate drops, man, I'm pooched. And this game show is pooched.
All right, so it's time for a Friday favorite. It's Game Show Friday! Joining us now on the line, a very special guest. We make it so if you're the seventh email when we announce it on Twitter that you're the guy who plays Game Show Friday, and this time it wound up being someone quite special. One of our favorite people in the world was the seventh emailer.
It's pretty cool.
And he joins us now. That would be from Pension Plan Puppets.
Yeah.
Yes.
Julian Sanchez.
What's up, bud?
Not much. How you doing?
We're good. You're going to love Game Show Friday today.
Is it all about
It's all about 93 and 17. It's all about Gilmore and Clarkie, Dougie and Wendell.
It's a lot of for those
who don't know Pension Plan Puppets, can you tell our listeners a bit about your blog, your new blog?
the news yeah. released. All Leafs all the time. Lots of anger, as can be expected.
Lots of humor.
My favorite part is when the Toronto Star or the Toronto Sun plagiarizes your blog.
Yeah, mine too.
does your lawyer like that as well?
I know the Sun lawyer does.
I think we were told repeatedly
that we're not supposed to say that they plagiarized us anymore.
What are you supposed to say? Sampled? Yeah. Like the rappers?
Exactly. It was an homage.
Hey, before we get to Game Show Friday, I want to ask you. You guys, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, were very early defenders of Philip Kessel before it became in vogue to defend Phil Kessel.
Yes. Big early adopters of Philip J. Kessel.
But why, though? What did you see in Philip J. Kessel that was so that everybody else was missing?
You saw those Hockey USA pictures. We saw a sex machine that could play hockey at elite level.
You know, hey, listen, to each his own, man. There's a lot. Listen, the internet's a big place. There's room for little guys and room for big guys, if you know what I'm saying.
That's right.
All right, Game Show Friday. I hand the mic over to Quizmaster Merrick and Julian. You've picked a hell of a day to come on, sir.
Merrick, all right. The questions. I'm pooched.
No. You're gonna get this. Who are number 93 before Doug Gilmour?
Oh, Alex Gadynyuk.
Yeah, you're not going to get questions like that. Too easy. You're getting questions on. That was right, by the way. Good for you. Today, in honor of Psycho Head Coach Patrick Roy, you are getting themed questions today all about the Hall of Fame netminder, Patrick Roy. Nice. Julian, my friend, are you ready to go?
All right, let's do it.
All right. Julian,
by the way,
always...
we're looking for a D average, 6 of 10, please. To win the fantastic prize, which, Merrick, do we have one in the queue today for him?
Yeah, I think we have another copy of the Greg Oliver book, Don't Call Me Goon.
Oh, it's a very good book. You'll like that a lot.
Yes, very good. All right, so question number one, themed Patrick Roy themed. All right. Along with goaltending coach Francois Allaire, Roy popularized which style of goaltending in the 90s?
The butterfly.
That is indeed the butterfly. You were off to a perfect 1-1. Do you remember you've seen this scene in montages all over the place. It is the Montreal Canadiens against the Los Angeles Kings. It is Patrick Roy on his knees winking at a Los Angeles Kings player. Who's that player?
It was Thomas Sandstrom, wasn't it?
You are good.
Whoa.
Julian from PPP. Thomas Sandstrom, indeed. Good for you. All right.
I'm dirty answering these Montreal Canadian questions.
That's okay. You can have a shower afterwards. You can scrub, get a loofah sponge, scrub yourself right down.
Know thy enemy, sir. Know thy enemy.
That's right. That's right. All right. Chicago and Montreal almost had a one-for-one trade consummated involving this goaltender before Patrick Roy was traded to Colorado. So the moment that Patrick Roy walked out of the Montreal Canadiens, the first deal that the Habs made, and it was close to being done, was with Chicago for whom?
For Hasek.
For Belfour. It was Ed Belfour for Patrick Roy, 1-for-1.
Really?
Yes, indeed. Yeah, wow. Interesting one, eh? How the world would have been different.
And then the Habs chose Jocelyn Thibault instead.
They did. They did indeed. Question number four. Who scored the last goal ever against Patrick Roy?
Whoa.
Was it Shanahan?
No, I'll give you a hint. It was the Minnesota-Colorado series, 2003.
Oh, Andrew Brunette.
You got it. I'll give it to you. Yeah. Attaboy. Andrew Brunette, wow. Indeed. Yeah, Brunette. See, Julian, though, he's not faking it. Julian knows his stuff.
I only wished that Statue of Liberty goal was the last one in Patrick Roy's career.
Patrick Roy was a fan of which NHL team growing up?
The Nordiques. Probably.
The Nordic Hughes, indeed. Congratulations. You got that one as well. You know you're Patrick Roy. I think you're closet. You might be closet.
Take it back.
How do you know? Hang on.
Yeah, is the pension plan puppets blog just a beard for you? Is this your beard blog?
Hey, why do you know Montreal so well when clearly everyone knows that Ottawa is Toronto's biggest rival?
Oh, geez.
Everybody under 35, anyhow. Okay. Patrick Roy played more years as an Avalanche or a Hab?
No more years as a Hab.
He did. 10 versus 8 as a Colorado Avalanche. You are rocking and rolling. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Ooh, one more and you get the book.
Nice.
December 2nd, 1995. A day that will live in infamy. Okay, Waugh gets the hook, right? Remember, Ronald Correa played my last game for the for this team. Who went in relief of Patrick Waugh when he got the hook against Detroit?
95. I don't know, Red Light Rafico?
No, it was not. It was Pat Jablonski who went on in relief that night. He would, you know what? We should try to find Jablonski because I bet he'd be a good guest to talk about what happened that night. He would be a fascinating guest.
You sitting there watching those goals go in?
That's right. Oh, hey, you know what? Actually, hang on. Really quickly. Yeah, I'm getting my shot. I'm getting my call. Hey, really quickly. We have a different prize for you now, considering this is, you know, you're a Maple Leaf guy and you just, you know, you're about to win this sucker. We'll give you the Dave Bedini book, the Keonomy, or do you already have it?
No, I don't.
Okay, okay. So win the sucker and you get the book coming, Julian. What did Patrick Waugh insist on having in the 1998 Olympics? What did he insist on for the 1998 games, as he told head coach Mark Krupp? The starting job of every single game. All right, so you've won it, so you got the Bedini book. Now, just for giggles, a couple of easy questions. Which QMJHL team does he own, manage, and coach? Or, well, used to. Well, he still owns it, but used to manage and coach.
Quebec Rempart.
And have they ever won a Memorial Cup?
No.
Yes, they have. 2006, beat Moncton. Yes, they did. Patrick
I'm
was
so proud of you. I'm so proud of you for not knowing that, by the way. Makes me feel better about life.
Didn't know a Memorial Cup question?
Yeah.
Yes.
Congratulations.
I'm a Leafs fan, not a hockey fan. Don't forget that.
God bless you, man. Gone. I'm an NHL fan, not a hockey fan.
Pricks, pricks, pricks. You have won, Julian, from Pension Pan Pluppets. My Search for the Lost Soul of the Leafs, Keon and Me, written by Dave Bedini. And if you've ever met Dave, you know, he's one of the coolest hockey guys to talk to. So you're going to stay on the line. And Matt's going to take all of your info. We're going to send you this book. But, oh, I don't know, do you have a blog you want to plug? Anything? They have a little, like, online presence you want to pimp out a little bit?
Yes. Visit Pension Plan Puppets, please. I have to.
Everybody. Everybody knows about Pension Pam.
You got to eat, baby. All right, very good. And then I guess what did you do predictions this year? By the way, did you do a top four for the newly christened Atlantic Division?
I think I did. Was it Boston? I did a couple of them. I think usually it was Boston, Detroit, guaranteed. Probably Ottawa, Montreal, fighting for third, and then third and fourth, and then Toronto. Maybe fourth or fifth. And maybe in the wild card playoff spot, hopefully.
Yeah, I was going to say, you think they're going to take five out of that division? Yeah.
We'll see.
Here's the burning question that everyone loves to, the pinata everyone loves to whack, Julian. Who do you start tomorrow against Ottawa?
James Reimer. He got the playoffs last year, first home game after the playoffs. He looked good in the first game. He deserves it.
But it's Reimer. Reimer.
Got to be starting Reimer.
Got to be starting Reimer.
That's some funny shit.
All right. All right, everybody.
Thanks, Julian. Thanks, bud.
Julian from Pension Plan, ladies and gentlemen. There he is.
Visit
he is.
That blog. That is the
seventh.
That is
seventh
awesome
email
blog.
Seventh
Just
email.
Just random.
That was pretty good. Who knew? Who knew?
Seventh inning. Yeah,
nice. That was some good. That was some good Patrick Waugh trivia right there. There's a few that I'd spaced.
Was
on.
That okay? Was that all right?
The brunette one I forgot about.
Well, I remember watching the game, and I'm thinking to myself, if Minnesota wins this thing, it's the last time we're going to see Patrick Waugh. So Jeff, whatever you do, always remember who scored the last goal. And it was, I think it was OT as well, Andrew Burnett. It was cheapy too. It's a little. I think he just like tucked it in the side of the net or something like that, or maybe it might have been a scramble in front. Well, it must have been because it was an Andrew Burnett raccoon goal. We're just pounding in the garbage from around the net. It's not going to be one of these like Mike Bossy streaking down the wing. Oh, look, there's a flash. There's a flame. That's got to be Andrew Burnett. He wires the top shelf and pops a water bottle. I think it's one of those 2-foot goals. Mm. Andrew Burnett.
Where Mama hides the cookies.
You, You knew the I had some peanut butter. You knew the Eddie Belfort trade, right? We talked about that before.
Yeah. Yeah. One of those great trades. That never
Thomas
happened.
Thomas Sands from Wink. The Thomas Sands from Wink.
No, I don't remember that one, actually. No.
That's a little montage that would show up here in Canada. Not a big deal. All right. Well, he got it. He did good. Yep. That was awesome.
This weekend, there are a bunch of games. You'll probably watch them all. It'll be very exciting.
For all of you fans of Teemu Selänne, Sunday, he makes his return to Winnipeg.
Yeah.
The last time we see Teemu Selänne in Winnipeg, perhaps.
I hope the crowd reacts to that.
If you see, the Winnipeg Jets fans are the funniest fans in all of hockey.
It's like watching it. It's like watching an NCAA game. Like
it's fantastic. Yeah. Are they like respectful to Teemu Selänne or do they chirp him?
Oh, dude, come on! I'm surprised they have fun with it. The Jets fans are slowly going to be constructing an idol of some sort on the ice during the game in his honor.
Okay, what happens if Jacob Trouba drops him coming in over the blue line?
Jacob Trouba will be assassinated by the fans. they will swarm around him like the zombies from World War Z, and he will not survive.
The mayor of Winnipeg shoots him from the bell tower.
All right, well, that's the show for this week. And it was a good week.
Eh?
I mean, you know, minimal interference from technical difficulties. Great guests.
Okay.
A lot of people love the back-to-backer of Brad May and Matthew Barnaby. It makes you think we need to get more ex-Sabres on the show.
Let's get Larry Playfair on the show. I'd love to talk to Larry Playfair. Or Jerry Korab. Jerry King Kong Korab. You got me all excited now. Larry Playfair.
I'll go Miro Chetan. Miro Chetan, I'd like.
Really?
Have we ever had Pat LaFontaine on? I know he was on my other show.
I don't think we've had Pat LaFontaine. I'd love to have LaFontaine on. You know who the best guest would be? As far as ex-Buffalo Sabre, who is always freaking hilarious and candid, is Alexander McGillney. The best. He's the guy who, before a playoff game, when he was asked, "Do you feel any pressure tonight?" And he said, and one of my favorite answers ever, the only pressure I feel is in the morning after a cup of coffee.
It's awesome. Amazing. Amazing.
Get me Elmo.
Oh, McGillney had another line about that, too. About, really? Shit, hang on. McGillney quote. Damn, he had some other amazing quote. Let me see if it's here.
This is good. This is a segment of the show called Greg Looks Stuff Up.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Really keeps things moving. We got a really quick-paced show, don't we? We don't, like, ramble on or meander off into topics and just play topic train.
Damn it. It's some quote about scoring when he was with the Devils, I think it was, and I can't remember what it was, but it is what it is. Sorry. Sorry, everybody, for wasting your time. I am Greg Wyshynski of Yahoo Sports.
Jeff Merrick of Sportsnet. Wish, you know where I'm going tonight? I would love to go desperately to the David Eno book launch, but Claire and I got tickets months ago to go see Nine Inch Nails.
Nine Inch Nails.
I'm off to Nine Inch tonight.
My lovely lady will be going to see Gravity, I believe, tonight, the super duper space movie from Alphonse.
That's supposed to be any good? The trailer looks good. Every time I see the trailer, it looks fantastic.
It's supposed to be amazing balls. Yeah.
All right. Well, let me know if it's amazing balls then on Monday.
And there it is. All right, everybody. Thank you for joining us once again. And we will talk to you next week. Bye.
Yeah. Thank you.